This week on Texas Scorecard Radio, you'll never believe who's recruiting liberal candidates to run for the Texas Senate, or maybe you will. We've also got flying mayors, litigious lawmakers, an interview on a tool the grassroots are using to fight back, and a commentary from Michael Quinn Sullivan. Welcome back, friends, to Texas Scorecard Radio. Turn off CNN and lend your ears, because we have some real news from around the Lone Star State that impacts you, the taxpayer. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios. Now let's go to Charles Blaine down in Houston. Charles, another week, another scandal involving Mayor Turner. This time he's flying the friendly skies at taxpayers' expense. Tell us about that report.
Yeah, so Turner's been doing a lot of travel, and as you know, he's nearing the two-year mark in office, and we did some open records requests to find out where he's been, and it seemed as though he's taken six international trips to eight different countries just in his first year and a half in office, and that's just international. That doesn't include, 16 domestic trips that he's taken, all totaling about $260,000, and according to the city's records, he's been traveling for about 65 days since being in office.
$260,000. Where has he gone with all that, spending this kind of money?
Yeah, so I mean, it's all over the place, honestly. He spent some days in Cuba, South Africa, Mexico, Bahrain, Israel. He went on a European tour to the United Kingdom, Germany, and Turkey. So he's been all over the place, really.
How does this compare to his predecessor and the travel that she took?
Well, surprisingly, he blows her out of the water. Everybody talks about how much his predecessor, Anise Parker, spent, but she only traveled one international trade mission in her first term in office. So that's 2 years, because we were on a different term schedule then. So in the same amount of time, he's traveled six times to eight different countries, and she only took one trip in that time period.
Wow, okay. So, there's some issues involved, and you go through this in the article you wrote for Texas Scorecard. There's some issues involved, not just with him taking these trips, but with, kind of the folks that are going with him. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it seems like it's been more or less of a free-for-all with all of his friends and political allies who've been going with him. There was a story a few months ago about the Super Bowl giving the city incentives and then Turner giving them out to his friends and relatives. Well, the same goes here. Some of the people that Turner provided Super Bowl tickets with, like State Representative Helen Giddings and his campaign treasurer and longtime donor Thomas Jones, also went with him to South Africa. Also interesting is that, prior to coming on as his chief of staff, his current chief of staff, Marvelette Hunter, also went along on that South Africa trip. And that was about 6 months before she was even appointed to that position. So, and there are a host of other folks with contracts with the city, like, the Linebarger firm that does debt collection and some other firms that have these longstanding contracts with the city who tagged along on these trips as well.
Wow. Well, I appreciate you doing all the digging there in Houston and uncovering all of these wastes of taxpayers' money. I encourage listeners out there to go to TexasScorecard.com. Charles has a great article up about this issue. I just encourage folks to go listen and learn and read and learn more about what's going on in the Bayou City. Thanks, Charles.
Thanks, Tony.
Let's go to Carrie Cheshire with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Carrie, you've got a report about a new entrant in one of the races for the Texas Senate. And kind of the interesting part is who recruited this candidate.
That's right. And a new story up on our website by our Houston Bureau Chief, Charles Blaine. We've got a story about a Fort Bend ISD board member who's running against State Senator Joan Huffman of the Texas Senate.
Yeah, and so this is a very liberal school board member. I think there was some talk whenever she announced that we thought maybe she'd run as a Democrat. She's entering the Republican primary against an incumbent Republican senator. But really the interesting thing is, kind of where this Senate candidate came from, who recruited her.
That's right, Tony. She was one of the few members of the school board who is there at the Texas Association of School Board Conference here in Austin, and was kind of recruited by House Speaker Joe Strauss to run for the Senate. He said at the meeting, we need more people like you to run for the Texas Senate, because he's been fighting school choice the whole time, and he needs more bureaucrats to get there. and hopefully bolster his votes.
Yeah, so the backstory here for listeners who may not be aware of the conflict in Austin, you have a very liberal Republican speaker, House Speaker Joe Strauss, who controls the House. You have conservative Republicans who are in control of the Senate. The conservative Republicans support school choice and more parental choice in schools, those kind of things. Strauss and his kind of backers are just, they kill it. They kill any kind of school choice measure every session. And so he goes down to the Texas Association School Board meeting. And this was the meeting where he called Governor Abbott's agenda horse manure.
That's
right. Very kind of aggravated and outspoken and boisterous about how opposed he was to conservative reforms, including school choice. And then he specifically singles out Tassin and says, hey, this is an ideal candidate for the Texas Senate. This candidate ought to run. Well, sure enough, now she's actually running.
She's actually running, and she's got commentaries out where she's saying, if elected, she's going to join what she calls the anti-Dan Patrick coalition in the Texas Senate. Kind of a really interesting challenge against State Senator Joan Huffman, who's kind of a middle-of-the-pack lawmaker in the Texas Senate, already been aggressively endorsed by Dan Patrick, who went to the Harris County Republican Party meeting and said, I need her back, so work for her. It's not the typical campaign that we've seen across the state where you see conservative members challenging establishment members of the Texas Senate. Now you have a member who's even farther to the left coming in and trying to make a play.
Yeah, so we have a conservative Senate and a relatively conservative senator and working with, conservative Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. And, here we have the House Speaker kind of breaking the House-Senate divide to go out and recruit a Senate challenger to run, to the left in the Republican primary for the Senate. Very, very interesting stuff. Well, yeah, thank you for that report, Kerry. I think I would encourage folks to go on and read that article and learn a little more about what's going on there in Fort Bend County.
Thanks a lot, Tony.
Let's turn to Zach Maxwell with Empower Texans. Zach, you had a recent article up about a Republican state representative who's threatening to sue his own local Republican party. Tell us what's going on there.
Sure, Tony. So State Representative Travis Clardy of Nacogdoches is threatening to sue the Cherokee County Executive Committee and Chairwoman Tammy Blair. So what happened is the Executive Committee is drafting a resolution to censure Representative Travis Clardy. Chairwoman Blair actually sent a courtesy message to Representative Clardy and just letting him know that, hey, we're drafting this resolution, thought you should know, just out of a courtesy. And instead of responding, trying to defend his record or anything in that nature, he actually threatened to sue.
That sounds like a heck of a way to win friends and influence people and secure your spot as the representative. So we have this group of local activists and precinct chairs in Cherokee County, and they're upset with their local representative's voting record, and frankly, they should be. Travis Clardy, on the fiscal responsibility index with Empower Texans, very low-scoring Republican on the index there. And so these constituents don't like Representative Clardy's bad record, so they want to do something that's within their authority, pass a resolution censuring him, saying, formally, we don't like the fact that you're not representing our values and our platform and our interests. And they just kind of give him a courtesy. Hey, we're going to do this thing. We know we're at odds here, but we want to be courteous and let you know that it's going to happen. And he turns around and threatens to sue him.
Yeah, it seems a little bit overboard, don't you think? I don't know where he's really getting the fact that he could sue over this. I mean, they're well within their right to file this resolution like many other, county executive committees have to their reps and to other reps. Representative Joe Strauss, Speaker Strauss, is actually the Cherokee County Executive Committee filed a resolution against him and one of their local county commissioners, but he doesn't think that he deserves to be censured, I guess.
Yeah, and so he not only responded and said, hey, I'm threatening to sue you, but he kind of conceded the point that he doesn't support the platform. Isn't that right?
Yeah, he told Tammy Blair, the county chairwoman, that the Republican Party platform was meaningless and that it was only meant to get people elected. Shocking.
Well, I think that's the whole issue with why they have to pass the resolution. Well, listeners who want to learn more, they can go to texasscorecard.com. Zach has that article up. Thank you for that report, Zach.
Thank you, Tony.
Well, it's great to have on the program Jeremy Blosser. Jeremy, I wanted to have you on to talk about Rule 44, which is something people are starting to talk about. We've been covering Rule 44 resolutions that are percolating up from local county Republican parties across the state of Texas over recent weeks. And you were kind of the primary author of Rule 44, the Republican Party of Texas. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that issue and the context of it. But first, tell listeners a little bit about who you are, your participation in the Republican Party, the things that you've done since you've gotten involved.
Sure, Tony. Thanks. So I got involved in politics. I've been active in politics and followed it, you know, my whole life. My undergrad degree was in that area, but wandered off into IT for several years post that. But then in 2007, really got involved in Texas Republican Party politics when Ron Paul ran for president. And I got involved in as a volunteer in that campaign, and kind of the way things go through the convention process, ended up directing a lot of the volunteer activity at the 2008 state convention for his campaign, and then, you know, back again in 2012. But got involved in Tarrant County Republican Party in 2007, 2008 as a precinct chair, a member of the rules committee there, pretty much stayed involved there continuously and continuously through the state conventions, kind of always as a getting more known as a process and rules person. Yeah, started attending SREC meetings in the 2012 cycle because of redistricting to help out with my work at TCGOP. Then eventually got on the SREC myself in 2014. So I'm in my second term there. Just, you know, continuing to be involved where I can be useful.
Yeah. And so you've been on the SREC, the State Republican Executive Committee. This is kind of the governing board of the Republican Party of Texas in a way. And there you are kind of viewed as of any of the folks that are there, kind of a parliamentary rules expert, that sort of thing. And so let's go to this most recent convention. You kind of led the effort to put in place an official party rule related to censoring Republican Party officials. Can you give us a little background of where that had come from and what was involved at the convention?
Yeah, real briefly, there's a pair of rules, 43 and 44, that people actually have been working on for a very long time, since the 80s. And that the pair of them, as they were originally conceived of by Bob Johnson, the goal was 43 was to have elected officials say what they believed, including pledging to support certain party core party principles, or at least tell you where they stood on them, whether they were going to support them or not, so you knew when you voted for them. And then 44 was going to be there as if they break their word, you know, read my lips, no new taxes, then they're going to have to come and explain themselves. And if you accept their explanation, fine. If you don't, there's a penalty. And it was both, the 1-2 there was all based around ballot access. You know, when you file for ballot access, you give your name and the office you're seeking, and the original goal was to add these check boxes for I've read the platform and this is what I believe on these principles in Rule 43. And then in Rule 44, you would add a check box for, you know, the party's never censured me this certain way. And, you know, some people supported those back when they first came out, some didn't. There's been a huge push from the establishment, especially their legal operations in and around the party, to kind of quash this. So over the years, they've kind of evolved and taken different forms. 43's got in a long time ago and has never quite been what it set out to be around the ballot, but it does have, tell us what you think of the platform. 44, we just kept hitting the wall, convention after convention after convention, and I've tried since 2008, since getting involved, every 2 years, we brought another version of it. This time as an SREC, I was on the rules committee myself and able to bring a version that kind of had incorporated all the feedback we'd gotten over the years for reasons people didn't like it and still didn't quite get what we want. The version we really wanted was with ballot access restrictions failed by one vote in the committee. But we had a backup. We had a plan B, which is the one that you see in there now that talks about denying support and making, you know, party non-compete or neutrality clauses no longer binding for a race that involves somebody.
Yeah, this is the penalty that is contemplated in the rule now. What I think the grassroots have wanted, at least the supporters of this rule have wanted, is to say, hey, you know, you can't run as a Republican if you've
been censured by the Republican Party, and they kind of cut you off from being able to associate with the party, was kind of the concept. This different concept says, well, we're not going to do that, but we're going to get rid of all these requirements that say, hey, we've got to be neutral and we've got to give you equal resources. Like, you know, if we don't like what you're doing in office, we don't have to associate with you. And I think ultimately it comes back to this idea that the Republican Party is a private organization. You know, we have this weird dynamic in law where we want to place the parties in law and we want to have these legal processes for people to run for office under a party label, but really these are private organizations. And this is kind of, in essence, Rule 43, Rule 44 are ways for this private association to kind of express itself and say, hey, we have things that we believe in and we expect our members to support.
Yeah, the parties are the, you know, one of the primary ways that the First Amendment provision for people to assemble peaceably and petition government to address their grievances actually happens. And yeah, parties get their guys elected, they get themselves in power, and they start changing the law to favor their party or one or two parties over the rest, and it gets confusing. It's not exactly what the intent was.
Yeah,
but we still, you know, are private organization and we get to choose who we associate with.
Yeah, and
you kind of wear our brand.
Yeah, you have this pushback from those who want to just use the party as a mechanism to get elected. They're not really interested in being associated with the Republican Party. They're interested in being elected under the Republican brand. They kind of want to co-opt the brand. And so that's been kind of the pushback. I wanted to talk a little bit and clear up a misconception. I see a lot of folks out there who they look at the rules and they don't quite understand how these rules fit with general parliamentary procedure and their statutory and constitutional rights, like how these things fit together. So kind of from a threshold standpoint, Rule 44 doesn't create the concept of censure. You know, censure is essential to an organization. Can you explain that distinction for listeners?
Yeah, censure is not created by Rule 44, and Rule 44 doesn't try to say this is the only type of censure that exists in the Republican Party. Censure really just means we disapprove of what you did. Several years ago, Tarrant County Republican Party censured, long before Rule 44 was in state party rules, we censured a judge for a DUI because it brought disrepute on the party. And there was no penalty or clause in there that contemplated any kind of punishment. It was just a statement of we don't like what you did. And this is a concept that's as old as parliamentary procedure. There's motions that say we like you as a commendation, and censure is kind of just the opposite of a commendation. What Rule 44 really is about is that other word, penalty. 44 provides provisions for penalties to be applied, and it's a process for them to be applied statewide. So if you have, for example, a House rep who has four counties, and maybe two of them have these local rules that say they have to be neutral in a primary and the other two don't even, what you could have happen is one of those four counties start the Rule 44 process and have it upheld all the way through the SRC or the convention. And then what they've done is started an action that impacts those other three counties, which was not something they could pass a motion of censure all day long, but they couldn't tell those other three counties, you're not allowed to support this person either. And that's what 44 applies, creates. It creates a method for you to do something that starts at the local level still, but once it's fully realized, it has statewide impact.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is taking something that they normally would be able to control locally, you know, control their own local party resources, their own local neutrality. Those things were controllable prior to Rule 44, but now we're going to say, hey, if we get the approval of the SRAC or the convention, we're going to tell other local parties, okay, you've got to kind of follow this this penalty process.
Yeah.
Right. So can you walk people through, like, how does Rule 44 work? If they want to invoke those statewide penalties, and again, the penalties are not all that severe, but it's getting rid of these neutrality requirements, getting rid of these resource equality requirements. If folks want to take advantage of that, what do they have to do?
First of all, I'd note that one of them is at least kind of severe. The party is forbidden from providing support beyond that required by law for that person, which would mean that if a person who had 44 applied still won their primary and went into the general election, the local party wouldn't be able to help them. And that
Well,
that, that's maybe under the radar for some people, but it is, it could be fairly significant in some districts. But yeah, the process is, it's a little weedy. It's got a lot of 2/3, 3/5 types numbers in it. But the bottom line is you need to prepare a resolution that you're going to bring to your local county executive committee or one of your local conventions that lists three things that this person did, concrete things this person did in opposition to the core principles of the party during the current biennium. So if you got a state rep or a state senator in mind, you need to go out and look at their voting record or their committee chair record and find three specific times that they took action publicly, you know, in their office against those core 10 principles of the party. So find a pro-life bill that they voted against, find a pro-gun bill that they, you know, let die in a committee that they were in control of. Those kinds of very concrete things. This isn't a court of law. There's not rules of evidence, but there are, it's rules of politics, right?
Sure. You,
politics being the art of the possible. You've got to find three things that, that the SREC or the convention is going to look at and say, yes, I agree. That meets a personal standard I have of things that, that directly go against these principles. So what I told people is find everything you can, find 10, find 20,
right,
and, you know, hope that when somebody looks at those who actually gets to vote on the final outcome, they're going to find three that that you know, they can uphold personally.
Yeah,
so find
they,
that list
they
of
don't
things.
Have to agree on the three. It's just they have to agree that there are at least three, that there's at least three violations that occurred.
Yeah.
Is kind of the agreement. And so
find those three, bring your resolution, and you want to, in your resolution, you want to include language that you are asking that if this resolution is passed by the 2/3 requirement, that it's going to, that you want it to go to the SREC, you want it to go to the convention, and you're asking them to uphold it and invoke Rule 44.
And so, and so if it's approved at the county level, then it would go up to the SREC where they would vote on it. That would impose the penalties, and then those penalties expire once you get to the convention. So then it would actually be a matter for the convention, you know, the next state Republican convention, the delegates there to say, hey, do we agree with this censure resolution?
Yeah, there's time limits that are in place just based on the fact that the party is a private organization that fully recreates itself every 2 years. We don't do anything like elect a chairman who is chair across multiple election cycles, or SREC members that, you know, have some kind of rotating membership. It's, everything is new every 2 years, except for, you know, what we hold in our heads. So if someone would bring a 44 now and the SREC at our next meeting in December would uphold it, then that would have impact on what's going on right now until the convention, which would be the primary.
Sure.
But then once we hit the convention, we're past the primary into the general election, that penalty would expire. And if the convention could look at it and they could go ahead and uphold it themselves, then it would last until the next convention, which means it would last through the general and the next primary, and then expire at the beginning of the next convention cycle.
Well, I'm seeing more and more as citizens are looking at this as a tool that they can use to hold their local elected officials accountable. And I really think this is going to end up being a very interesting issue as we get into the next convention, maybe to strengthen the rule, add additional possible penalties, adjust it in certain ways. And I think we may end up debating who we want to censure or not at that convention. Could be very, very interesting for delegates.
Yeah, I think it will be. And, you know, I know some people think this is going to turn into a witch hunt or a Spanish Inquisition type thing. I don't really think that's the case. I think that if some of the worst one or two offenders who really do not care what the party set, what the platform says, and they're just running as a Republican because it's a checkbox, it's how you get elected. You know, I think if one or two of those get corrected and told, no, how you vote does matter to the primary voters, I think you'll see a lot of people who either start changing their votes, start reading the platform, or maybe decide that they're better suited for another line of work.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the way you take care of foxes getting in the hen house is you got to kill a few of the foxes and nail their hides to the side of the hen house. So I think it's good to send these signals. Well, thank you for joining us on the program, Jeremy. I appreciate all of your work on the SREC, and thank you for explaining this to our listeners.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We'll conclude this week with a commentary from Michael Quinn Sullivan. You know, free speech is under attack here in the Lone Star State. Michael will tell us why it's up to us to fight back and defend our rights.
George Washington said that freedom of speech was critical, and that without it, dumb and silent, we may be led like sheep to the slaughter. I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with today's Texas Scorecard Commentary. A disturbing trend in higher education, including at a college in Texas, has liberals using threats of violence to silence conservatives with the approval of college administrators. Colleges and universities were once bastions of free speech in general and political speech in specific. No longer. And let me make this quick point before going any further. The First Amendment to the Constitution is all about political speech. Our founding fathers would be disgusted by the way the First Amendment has been contorted and distorted. They intended to protect political speech because they understood all too well that freedom in general is tied to freedom of speech in particular. I started today's commentary with that quote from Washington. That wasn't a cute turn of phrase on his part. It was reflective of the heartfelt consensus of our founding fathers. Sadly, we've reached a point where the First Amendment is used to protect the rights of perverts to freely share dirty pictures and unmentionable acts on video, even as political speech is highly regulated. Over the last 2 years, however, we've seen the left move from regulating political speech to using violence and the threat of violence to silence conservatives. Let's make no mistake, every single political speech regulation on the books is there because liberals and their cronies in the deep state have placed them there. Every single one. Across America, throughout history, and around the world, it's exclusively the big government statists who use official power to silence the voices of liberty. In the past year, liberal Democrats have begun using the violence of orchestrated mobs to silence those who cannot be regulated. And nowhere is this happening more often than on college campuses. My colleagues Sal Aea and Austin Goss have cataloged this disturbing trend. In November 2016, a leftist mob rushed the University of Wisconsin stage where the Daily Wire's editor Ben Shapiro was speaking. They didn't want the outspoken conservative on campus, and so they used violence to shut him up. The University of California, Berkeley, the self-proclaimed home of free speech, has seen repeated acts of violence and destruction by liberal groups attempting to stop conservatives from appearing on campus. It goes on and on. The most recent incident took place right here in Texas. Conservative State Representative Briscoe Kane of Deer Park was invited to speak on the campus of Texas Southern University, a publicly funded college in Houston. Kane's invitation came from the Federalist Society, a conservative group for law students. The event was scheduled through the university and had the full approval of university officials, right up until a Democrat state senator and a violent mob disrupted the event with the tacit approval of the president of the university. As Kane took to the stage, a Black Lives Matter mob entered the room and headed for the stage. State Senator Boris Miles, a far-left Democrat known for brandishing firearms and threatening business associates, entered the room with the university president at the same time. On his command, the mob stopped their advance, and Miles told Kane to leave with the campus police, you know, for his own safety. The college president looked on and not only did nothing, but covered for this act of intimidation and official suppression of speech. Since the incident, the university has gone into full spin mode, first lying about the event and then backpedaling as videos emerged. Letting a mob of liberal students and a Democrat state senator shut down the speech of a Republican state representative isn't a good look for any Texas university. Quite frankly, the president of Texas Southern University should be fired or see the institution lose its tax-funded status. And State Senator Boris Miles should be expelled from the Texas Senate for his role in egging on a mob of leftists who tried and actually succeeded in silencing a conservative speaker. Now, it's unlikely either will happen, but they should. Without a swift response to Texas Southern University, the leftist mob will be encouraged to do it again and again. If we allow political speech to be stifled today, all our freedoms will be taken away tomorrow. Conservatives must zealously push against the mobs who would violently silence speech and unravel the regulations that criminalize political participation. With today's Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan.
Before you go, I wanted to encourage listeners to go to texasscorecard.com. I've got a comprehensive report up this week about the Retama Park development. If you've ever wondered how a group of horse gambling lobbyists came to dominate the Texas House of Representatives, I've got a lot of answers there. That's all I've got for you this week. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.